Art Bell is taking calls on the Wildcard Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Well, okay, here again I am. My guest is Stan Tenney. We're talking about the Bible Code. Now, he agrees with Michael Drusnin that there is a Bible Code. I don't think that I fully understand it, and that probably means a lot of you don't either. So, we're going to try it again here from the beginning. It's a difficult concept to grasp visually, and so I think it's even more difficult to grasp when you're trying to form word pictures of what all this means. We'll try it again in a moment. Here once again is Stan Tenney. And Stan, this is very rough stuff.
Let's back. You know, it only took me 30 years, so I think we need to give the audience more than 30 minutes to come up to speed on this.
Well, we're an hour into it, so go ahead.
Well, then it's about time we delivered, right?
Right.
Let's back up and tell people what these codes really are, because I think that's one of the reasons we're lost, is that people don't know what it is we're looking at.
All right, there are codes in the Bible.
Yeah, there's a new book that's come out, which has nothing to do with me, and I haven't seen the book, it only just came out, by a well-known journalist author that is reporting on work that was reported in peer-reviewed scientific journals, so we know the technical work was done properly. It indicates that there is coding in the Hebrew Bible. Now, what kind of coding is the question? What they found is they did a computer search, and they started on each letter, and they counted so many letters, a fixed number of letters, and wrote down the next letter. So they count out, say, 49 letters and write down a letter. It counts 49 letters and write down a letter.
Okay.
And when they did this, they found in many cases that these sequences of skip patterns spelled out words that were meaningful. And they also found that there were other skip patterns that sort of intersected the first skip patterns that were meaningful with them. So they'd find reading across a rabbi's name, and they'd find reading vertically the date of birth of the rabbi.
Wow.
And this is, of course, a rabbi that would have lived a couple of thousand years after Moses was given the Torah. So that it would appear to be a very prophetic thing. At least that's the interpretation that most people are giving.
Drusnin is regarding these codes as prophetic. In other words,
I haven't read his book, so I do not know exactly what he's saying. I know the statisticians are presenting evidence that something special is going on.
All right, Drusnin says it's a completely broken code of people, dates, places, times, such as JFK, President Dallas killed, assassin to assassinate, shot in head, that kind of thing.
I've read reports of that, and in fact I've seen some of that, and I'm saying there are better explanations that haven't been explored, and we can get into those. But I wanted to first establish what we're looking at. We're looking at counting so-called equal interval letter skip patterns and reading off the words that occur when you do this sort of a skip pattern.
Yes.
And the arguments and the patterns are really there. Everyone who's examined the statistical work says nobody's made a mistake. The odds are overwhelming in some cases, although not so strong in others. And we should talk about the difference there. But these patterns, at least the majority of these patterns, are definitely really there. So the question becomes, are they prophetic? What do they mean? How do they get there? Why are they there, etc.? What's the context for them? What are they telling us? Is it some sort of random thing? And the answer is no. It's not a random thing. There's real information there.
All right. Well, but if they find something that says JFK, President Dallas killed, assassin to assassinate, shot in head.
Well, they're not. They're finding things that are a little more ambiguous than that. For instance, one of the most famous ones that they're talking about appears to have Yitzhak Rabin's name.
Yes.
And the intersecting pattern says, assassin will assassinate. That's how it's being reported.
Right.
The trouble is that the Hebrew is ambiguous. It may not say assassin will assassinate. It may say Yitzhak Rabin will assassinate someone else. I've seen rabbinic forums where this is being discussed. So even though I don't have great expertise in the Hebrew language, I know that unless there's no vowels present when they take these patterns, unless you vowelize them, you can't read them unambiguously. So in many cases, such as the one with regarding Rabin, they really aren't finding anything at all, and you certainly couldn't find it before it happened.
So you're
never,
saying
never,
in order
noticed such a thing.
In order for it to say Rabin, they've got to add vowels.
Well, you would think they would, but they don't. They spell in modern Hebrew. The people understand the language and the conventions well enough that you can usually interpolate something you're familiar with. But in biblical Hebrew, you can't do that. In fact, one of the major differences between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam is over how to read the fine levels of meaning of a text, depending on how you vowelize.
Why would there be codes in the Bible at all?
Ah, now you ask the question that is not being properly asked, and that's what I'd like to address.
Please do.
All right, first let's take a look at what's going on here. We have a situation where statisticians have determined that there are patterns. This information is being used by different groups of people with different preconceived notions to support their preconceived notions. The same patterns that the religious Bible scholars are saying prove that the Bible is prophetic are being used by academic Bible scholars to prove that the texts were deliberately encoded to include these patterns as kinds of checksums, and that the prophetic stuff is not legitimate.
Checksums.
Well, the idea is that if you have a sacred text, you don't want to make any mistake in copying it.
Yes, sir.
So you do what accountants do. You create kind of numerical schemes for double-checking
the
text.
Yes, okay. So checksums to ensure that if there is a change and somebody understands there are checksums, you will understand where that change has occurred.
That's right. This isn't a checksum per se, but it has the same function. At least that's what the academics who are looking at this data are saying. What I'm saying is that both of these groups have jumped the gun, and that, in fact, statistical science is based on having a model. Neither group has a model of how these codes are coming to being, what they're doing, and so they're sort of shooting in the dark and finding things that have high statistical probabilities or low probabilities, and therefore they're thinking they're special, but they can't sort coincidences from really important discoveries.
So
that's number one effect.
You're saying Drosnin is wrong. His conclusions, based on the undisputed statistical information, are incorrect.
Yeah, I'm saying in general, just about everyone's conclusions so far have been incorrect because people have been jumping the gun on the conclusions. They've been taking the raw data that says, yes, there really are patterns, and they've been sorting that data in a way that makes their case look good, better than they should. They're not being good scientists. They're being biased.
All right. Why is your science better? Why is your finding of the tetrahedral, for example, any more meaningful than JFK, President Dallas killed assassin?
Because they have different implications and they apply different things. For instance, the rabbinic scholars believe this is miraculous. I shouldn't use them as a group. There are many different people saying many different things, but the people that are pushing this as prophetic think it's miraculous. I don't see anything miraculous here. And once you say it's miraculous, you can't do anything with it. It's just given as a miracle. You just accept it. That doesn't seem to me to be sufficiently important. Likewise, the other groups are saying that this is just mundane. Someone just put this in, and that the prophetic seeming stuff is accidental.
Accidental?
I
understand the concept of a checksum, because something that is intended to travel, in effect, through the ages, you would want to be sure it was not changed. I understand.
The first thing you want to do in examining something like this is go back and look and see if you can find if sages and scholars in past generations in related traditions have said anything about these patterns. Because, in fact, here's the crux, and I think your audience will understand this.
Okay.
Let's say you find a rabbi's birthday and a rabbi's name correlated by these patterns in the text.
Okay.
If you assume that with the aid of modern computers, we're the first people to have ever discovered these patterns, then you have to assume that the rabbis couldn't have rigged this in any way, that there couldn't be any cheating, that this has got to be prophetic. But if you make the assumption that sages in past ages, before the Inquisitions, before some of the bad things of history have happened, knew about these patterns, then of course you have to explain how they could have done it, and I can explain that very simply. If you assume they did know the patterns, then giving a rabbi a name based on his birthday that you already knew was correlated in the Torah would be a way of honoring the child and honoring the Torah. And that could easily have happened. There are many possible explanations for these correlations if you assume the patterns were previously known. Neither of the groups doing the research are making that assumption. Both the academic and the rabbinic scholars are rather, I would say, and I use this with all due respect, arrogantly assuming that only us modern folks are smart enough to have found these sophisticated patterns. Mm-hmm. Now, let me explain why that's not true. These patterns are utterly obvious to the naked eye if you understand how coding was done and how texts were produced in the ancient world and what science was used for in the ancient world. We know that people were studying planetary cycles in the ancient world, and the sky and the motion of the planets and the stars and the constellations.
Exactly.
We know they were doing this not only because they wrote about it, but because they had accurate calendars.
Right.
Okay. So that's a technology that they were interested in, that was vital to their survival, they knew about. We also know that they had other technologies that are perennial in human history. We know that Egypt, for instance, was and always has been known for its textiles. We know that ancient peoples wove things and were very good at weaving things, weaving cloth, weaving baskets, even weaving maps. Polynesians and Micronesians still weave tidal and star maps in order to navigate.
Yes.
So we know weaving technology, knotting and braiding and embroidering, were big time, making carpets, making clothing, and in fact, keeping records in terms of tapestries. A minstrel might embroider into their clothing the reminders for how to sing their songs or what they were teaching people. People didn't have books. They had clothing.
So you are suggesting that these codes were woven.
They were woven. And you look at these letter skip patterns, you're looking at, for all intents and purposes, a Navajo rug, where the skip patterns are simply there because the text was woven. And if you examine the form of the loom, of the I don't know what you call it. I'm not a weaving person. If you look at the frame that was used to hold this weaving, it turns out to be you're looking at the patterns in the heavens, the motions, the cyclical motions of the stars and the planets and the constellations. Literally weave what mathematicians now call torus knots, but they weave them on the temples of the heavens. And here is what's really going on. I have to back up one more step. I don't know if we have time before you have to take a break, but
no,
I'll try it.
Go ahead.
Okay. Most people, including most Jews, certainly most Christians and Muslims, are not aware of what I'm going to say. And, in fact, if you want, in the break, I can actually find a reference. And I hate to read references on the air. It's so boring. But I can even find a reference for you.
That's all right.
It is taught that when King Ptolemy ordered the Sanhedrin, 70 rabbis, to make the first Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, the rabbis of the time said that this was the greatest tragedy that had ever happened, even worse than the golden calf, because, in fact, the text could not be translated as it was intended to be, which meant that when you make a translation into another language, whatever coding they could be at the letter level would be lost. And so the text became understood as nothing but narratives and stories. Now, I'm not going to say that these stories don't have enormous meaning in themselves. They do. People didn't make these stories up. They drew them from real history and et cetera. I'm not at all disputing the standard understanding of the Bible here. But I'm saying, at a deeper level, that translation, that Septuagint translation, defined the meaning of the Hebrew text in modern language for the first time and erased the coding at the letter level underneath for people who didn't look at the original. By the way, the Quran is supposedly not translated either to preserve patterning in it, so this may go well beyond the Jewish and Christian tradition, too. And so what we have is a history that says that there was coding. We have a Kabbalistic tradition based on there being coding. And then, and here's the other thing that's astonishing, these academic scholars, these religious scholars, all of whom are honorable, caring, decent people and doing a good job, have failed to do part of their job. Because if you look at the Kabbalistic tradition, if you look at the Talmud, if you look at what the Sufis and the Christian mystics and the Jewish mystics and related traditions and peoples are saying, you find that their sacred geometry has the same numerical skips as are being discovered in the text. What I was talking about earlier, about this model hand that generates the letters that we found by lining up the letters in Genesis,
right?
That hand is exactly the same length as the skip pattern that is most common. The most common skip pattern is 49 letters, and in fact, that's exactly the length of the hand model. And so if you were to write the Torah out on these models that we found, these cyclic models that come from the patterns in the heavens, the text would line up with these patterns in concentric bands, and you'd see them immediately.
All right. So what, then, do you think this means?
Now I have to go a little farther into the deep philosophy, and we have to ask ourselves what the Bible is about. And we know, at some level, it's the story in the Bible. That's what everyone knows.
Right.
But the Bible is not just recapitulating religious and cultural history. It's intended to lay out a path that we can walk on, that we can follow,
right,
to emulate the teachings of the great rabbis and sages of the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible and Islam and the Quran. We're supposed to somehow internalize this. We're supposed to go on a, and I use this with all due respect, on a hero's journey that enables us to walk, to retrace the footpaths of these sages and saints so that we'll experience what they experienced, not just a head trip. How do you do that? Where are the instructions? We know in the Eastern traditions they have mudras and asanas, they have meditations, they have all kinds of experiential dances and exercises you can do to lead you to an experience that brings you closer to the reality of the transcendent.
All right,
like looking at the Grand Canyon. But,
right, right, I understand. So what you're saying then is that the meaning of what you have discovered,
yes,
is that each of us, if we follow this path, can come to enter an altered state. I'm using words that I think my audience will understand. An altered state that will allow us to experience what those who wrote the text experienced.
Exactly. And let me even put it in simpler terms. I'm going to date myself here, but I remember back in the 1950s, there were Arthur Murray dance studios all over the country, and they literally would teach you ballroom dancing by having you step in footprints painted on the ballroom floor. Remember that?
Yes, of course. Then,
right.
Then are we to then understand how creation, we're talking about Genesis here,
mm-hmm,
will this lead us to an understanding of how creation occurred?
Yes, that's what's going on. This is not just a story of creation, which you can debate about creationism, the years and dates. No. At a deeper level, this is an experience of the creative principle that we can have a taste of,
okay,
by using the letters as footprints in our mind. Did that work?
That works.
Okay.
Now, all of a sudden, it dawned on me.
So the Bible is not just a story that contains prophecy, and that we could debate at the historical level. It's a means by which we can learn to do these exercises, to walk this hero's journey for ourselves, to have this be a route of personal discovery. And this is a route of personal discovery that's not often some New Age special place. This is one that was intended and is intrinsic to the all of the Abrahamic traditions together. This is a common ground that all self-aware creatures can taste of.
Have you experienced this yourself?
The short answer is yes, but I don't want to build myself up. I've experienced some of it. I'm not a guru, and I'm not a master. I'm a researcher. I've done enough to tell you of my own experience.
Yeah, but according to your own words, you don't have to be all of that.
That's right.
I'm
telling you this is real. I'm telling you that I've had a taste of this, and that others I know have had too, and that there's a lot more to do than I've tasted. But you don't have to blow up the world to know atomic energy is real. We've tasted enough to know this is real. We haven't blown up the world. So there's much more to do. I don't think I'm a sufficiently centered or pious enough or I have a low enough ego level that maybe I don't even qualify to take this very deeply. You have to be a really genuinely open and spiritually and emotionally sound person to dare to do this, because there are stories of risk involved, too.
Oh, I believe that. All right, stay right where you are. Stan Tenen is my guest, and we are talking about a code. That's right, a code in the Bible. We'll be right back. All right, Art, your ignorance of the Bible continues to amaze me. This is from somebody who will only issue initials SH. I wonder what they mean. Hidden meaning, probably. He goes on, there is one interpretation, many applications. For example, Exodus 20:13, thou shalt not kill, is also, you shall not murder. Out of context, this can mean anything. In context, the meaning is quite clear. The Bible says what it means. It was conceived by God, penned by man. Why would God write a confusing puzzle with many meanings? He didn't. He is not the author of confusion. Stan?
Well, that's just based on a certain way of understanding what happened. The historical record is that the original texts were without word divisions and without vowelization. The rabbis preserved the meaning by means of the oral Torah, which tells us where to divide the words up and how to vowelize them. The non-Jewish world divides the words mostly the same way, but vowelizes slightly differently, which produces shades of meaning that gives you differences between the King James and the Catholic version and the Masoretic Hebrew version and many others. I don't think that the King James translators got as direct a message as came down originally, and I don't think English is capable of expressing exactly the same ideas as Hebrew is. No two languages are. But in fact, I really am not qualified to debate any of this. I'm not a Bible scholar. I have nothing but admiration for the text. I see no reason to dispute the text as the stories have come down.
You're not disputing, are you? You're simply saying laid within it.
Well, let's be clear here. These codes are not written in the Bible per se. These are skip patterns. This isn't a word that King James's translators or the Hebrew translators included in the story.
No, I know. They're skip
patterns.
This is
like a crossword puzzle.
I understand.
What your fax is saying really doesn't apply here. This isn't a word that we know. This is a disputed term that's been discovered. It doesn't come with vowels.
No. What I'm saying is that in addition to what is written, which is the obvious and which we could argue, but let's not.
That's right.
But in addition to that, not negating it in any way, in addition to it, you are suggesting in these skip patterns, there are forms, tetrahedral forms, for example.
Well, we'll talk about what forms there are. There's more than that.
I'm sure.
As we identify.
At any rate, that will lead a person into an experience which is actually described in the Bible, in the case of Genesis, creation.
That appears to be the case. Some of the patterns appear to be actually descriptions for the meditational exercise that would lead to the experience. Other part of the patterns appear to describe the tools of the trade, the priestly garments, some of the temple furniture, instructions for building the temple and the tabernacle, some of the Kabbalistic and Sufi and mystical models that are used in the Western traditions. And so the models start with the most stark elegance, with this tetrahedral light in the meeting tent.
So there is no reason for this anger, because you are not in any way suggesting that the actual words are not to be taken literally.
To be clear, at the moment, I'm not a true believing type person, but I am an Orthodox Jew. I keep the Sabbath, I keep kosher, I say daily prayers, and I believe that the Bible is recording something very valuable that we should take at face value and that we should understand and interpret as best we can. And I believe that just like different organs in my body interpret my DNA somewhat differently, we all are part of the body politic, and the Christian and the Jewish and the Muslim and various other interpretations all must be brought to bear together in mutual respect to get at what's really going on.
And now, back to the best of Art Bell.
Here's another one. Perhaps Stan could shed some light here. For some time, I've noticed that if you take the Hebrew word for breath and track it in English versions, where it is often translated as spirit or soul, you end up with a Hebrew version of a meditation manual where breath is key.
That's improbably correct in some context. The Hebrew word ruach can mean spirit or internal breath. It can even mean just an airstream. You have to know the context. In a Kabbalistic text, in a mystical text, ruach very often refers to spiritual breath. In in a more naturalistic setting, perhaps in one of the later books of the Hebrew Bible, ruach could very well refer simply to just breathing. I don't know. Again, I'm not a Bible scholar, but the facts, the person who sent the facts is correct. That same term is used both for external meaning and internal meaning, and it's hard to tell which applies where.
All right. You began at the beginning with Genesis. How far have you gone in trying to determine if this skip code
excellent question.
Continues?
Excellent question. Before I knew of the statistical work, I had to do this work because it was important to find out. My first thought when I saw these patternings at the beginning of the Hebrew text of Genesis was, how far did they go? If this was only the first verse, it could have been a coincidence. It could have been a preamble.
Sure.
I mean, there are a lot of simple explanations.
Exactly.
So my first job, before I even found what this was to determine if it continued. So I checked the first week, which is 7, 8 verses, 10 verses, and it continues through there. I checked the middle verses, and I checked the last verse in Deuteronomy. Rabbi Fleer insisted I do that, and he found the same patterning. But even more interestingly, this model not only produces the shapes of the letters and hand gestures, but it also produces the meanings of the letters. And I had determined that the letters Vav, Samach, and final Mem in Hebrew referred to golden mean functions. And there is a traditional teaching that the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, is a, quote, tree of life for those who grasp it.
You suggested you might not be worthy of the experience that this imparts. The rabbi that you have been working with, presumably, speaking for him, he would be. Has he tried it?
No, actually, there are a large number of rabbis I'm working with, and plus people in academia and in the sciences. No one that I know of has tried it for a couple of reasons. One, this is still work in progress. We are not certain of all the gestures, and we're not certain of how to use them all. So there's a good deal more needs to be done before anybody goes deeply into this.
Mm-hmm.
A number of people have tried it to some extent and have reported extraordinary results that are indicative that what we're doing is correct.
Like
but nobody
what?
Is nobody has done the full thing.
Stan, like what?
Well, I can tell the audience something they can try for themselves.
All right.
Which is very simple, and you don't have to use my models or anything, or even the Bible text. You can simply find out for yourself what happens here as a kind of experiment in consciousness.
All right.
Lie down, get comfortable, move your hands around with your eyes opened in front of you, point at the ceiling, point at the wall, point at the floor, get a good idea of what your hand looks like, make various gestures, make a little catalog of gestures.
Mm-hmm.
Then close your eyes and move your hands and see if you can get the sense of the gestures without your eyes actually being open. Most people can do that fairly quickly. Then after you've gotten really good at seeing your hands while you're making the gestures with your eyes closed, then lie down and put your hands at your sides. Don't move your hands and continue to make the gestures in your mind's eye. And I think you'll find that that leads to a rather extraordinary experience for some people.
Which is?
Well, it's hard to describe an experience. I hate to use words like this. I really try to be as academic about this as I can, because people do get overly excited. It's like having a second body. It induces a kind of out-of-body state. You're creating an alternate space in which you can act, and you're doing it in your mind's eye without moving your actual body. Different people will have different experiences, and if you're not ready, you won't experience anything. I mean, you know, just moving your hands. There's no people shouldn't feel bad if it doesn't work. My feeling is that there's a lot more to learn here before people go off and doing this, and I'll tell you why. Most people are unaware that at the same time as the Christian faith was being founded, there was a similar track going on in Judaism. There was a Rabbi Akiba who lived about, I don't remember exactly now, maybe 100 years after the time of Jesus. And he and three companions learned to do a special meditation, which the rabbis don't discuss in great detail.
Mm-hmm.
But Rabbi Akiba was known to be the master of the alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the authors, supposedly, or at least one of the people who wrote down some of these Kabbalistic texts.
Do you think that's how he came up with that meditation?
Well, you have to hear the story. The story is that the four of them independently attempted the meditation, guy was so entranced by the splendor of the experience that he died, didn't come out of the meditation.
Uh-huh.
The second guy was so overwhelmed. Now, these were all qualified people. Second guy was so overwhelmed that he came back and he was somewhat crazy. He was just spaced away, I guess we'd say today. The third guy comes back, and whereas he had enormously powerful experience, it was so powerful, he lost all of his faith and became a rationalist. Now, that's just one way of describing it. There's more to it than what I'm saying. And only Rabbi Akiva, who's the hero, comes back from this meditational experience whole and intact. That's the story.
In other words, don't try this at home.
Right. Now, the experience, there's more to it. The experience is called the Pardes experience, P-A-R-D-E-S. And that's the Hebrew word from which the word paradise comes. And it refers to the Garden of Eden.
I'm sorry, P-A-R-D-E-S,
Pardes.
Experience.
And it means paradise. And it refers to the four levels of the Torah, which is the verbal level and two intermediate levels, and then this letter level. So it's an acronym for the whole process. And what Rabbi Akiva reports is that he has this Pardes experience. He then comes back from the experience and appoints a general that was fighting the Romans, a guy named Ben Kasiba, as Bar Kokhba, which means son of the star, the Jewish Messiah. Bar Kokhba is killed by the Romans, and Rabbi Akiva ends up being skinned alive, which is a terrible, gruesome thing when you think of it in the physical sense.
Of course.
But if you think of it metaphysically, spiritually, being skinned alive means having an ego death experience, because your skin separates your inside from your outside. And that's, in fact, the crux of the whole story. Because in the Talmudic tradition, and in their parallels in all the Western faiths and everywhere else as well, a righteous person is said to be morally transparent. Their inside is like their outside. The Hebrew phrase is toku kavara. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. If one can make one's insides just like one's outsides, one will have this enlightenment, ego death, out of body, near death, transcendental experience, appropriate to your faith and context, if you do this gently.
You will touch paradise.
You'll touch paradise. Now, I want to finish it here if we have time, because it gets very powerful very quickly. How do you do this? Well, that's what's in the Torah. If the Torah includes, woven into the text, the cycles on the temples of the heavens, and if we can internalize them by chanting these texts, which is how they're read, they're chanted, and map the patterns on the temples of the heavens, on the temples of our mind, by means of our hand, which connects the two, then our insides and our outsides are the same. And we have an ego death and rebirth experience, which is, with all due respect, and I, as a Jew, do not want to tell Christians what to believe. That would be very arrogant of me. But I do believe that that's related to the experience that the Christian Gospels are discussing.
Born again.
And that's related, that's right, to the experience of Rabbi Akiva. And there's somewhat of a confirmation of this. I guess it's approximately 1,000 years later, maybe a little later than that, in under King James II of Aragon. In Spain, under the Inquisition, a disputation is ordered between Rabbi Nachmanides, the leader of the community, and Pablo Cristiani, a convert to Christianity. And the issue is, who's the Messiah? And it boils down to a statement in the Talmud, I believe, that the Messiah will be born when the temple is destroyed. And so Pablo Cristiani asks Rabbi Nachmanides, well, the temple was destroyed 1,000 years ago. How come you don't accept Jesus? And Nachmanides says, just because someone is born doesn't mean that's when they act in the world. So Pablo Christiani asked Nachmanides, all right, where's he been waiting all this time? And Nachmanides replies, the Messiah is in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden, in the Pardes meditation. What I'm saying is that the path, with all due respect, that Moses walked up and down Mount Sinai, that Jesus walked, that Muhammad walked, that the great prophets and sages of the Abrahamic faiths walked, is recorded letter by letter as a hero's journey of the soul in the Bible texts. And that's what these patterns are artifacts of, and that if one examines the Kabbalistic tradition, one finds that the numbers line up. There are 49 levels in Zer Anpin, one of the central images in the Kabbalah. The 49-letter skip pattern is predominant in the text. And there are many other examples, which we can go into a little later.
But quite obviously, you're suggesting that without the proper spiritual maturity, this experience is one you might not come out of.
Well, that's what tradition teaches. And in fact, let me be clear what the proper spiritual experience is so people will understand. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand this. You do not have to be a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim. Although it helps, I suppose. You have to be what the meditation is about. You have to be striving for maximum in your life, as you can do it, the best emotional and the best intellectual honesty and integrity that you can muster.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to make yourself morally transparent. That's what the meditation's about. That's why all of our faiths teach that the greatest person is the humblest person.
Well, you know what? Now I think I finally understand exactly what you're saying, and I must say, in my own mind, from a common sense point of view, your interpretation of this code makes more sense to me than Mr. Drosnin's interpretation, which seems to suggest it was some sort of Nostradamus-like predictive tool.
That's right. That's a flattening of the idea. It's on the right track, but it's a two-dimensional interpretation of something much richer.
Much richer indeed.
Yeah.
And it is attainable. And it certainly is not in conflict. So the anger expressed by those who read the Bible and say, baloney, it means exactly what it says, they're right, and you may be right too.
Yeah, one of the extraordinary things about what we've done, and one of the things I've insisted on, is that what our findings must do, if they're correct, is to support what the great sages of our traditions have been teaching all these years.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to find something that was in radical contradiction to what the great rabbis and the great priests and the great imams have been teaching, then the chances are, I'm just a guy here. I don't have a great education. I'm probably wrong. And so I insisted that what we found must be understandable in terms of technology we know is available in the ancient world, must be consistent with the moral and ethical teachings of the great faiths, and must be also consistent with what the academic linguists and historians and archaeologists have been telling us. That's a tall order. But this model seems to do that. Now, that doesn't make it right, but it makes it a good model to check out.
So the Bible is meant to be more than just what it says. It is meant to be, if you understand this coding properly, the key to actually experiencing and understanding.
Yeah.
For example, creation. My God, that's incredible.
Let me put it, if we have just another second. You know how it's impossible, no matter how you try, to explain what an orgasm feels like to a child that has reached puberty?
Of course.
Well, we're talking about meditational experiences of that level of intensity. We can show logically that they ought to be there. We shouldn't believe it until someone's done it and reported on it to us. And we shouldn't believe it, finally, until we can taste it ourselves. And I'm quite confident that can be done if people will take this seriously
and
enough.
And even then, people will not be able to explain it to each other than to say it is an ultimate life experience.
To the extent of our own humility, we can experience its heights. The whole key here is unless you... I'd like to do something really beautiful after the break, and I don't want to start it now, that shows the relationship between the three Western faiths, and I think it's something that the audience might really appreciate.
Also,
the key to doing this.
Well, what I would also like to do is open the lines, if we could. I want to see if they are grasping this. In the final hour, I do believe that we've grasped the key of what you're trying to talk about, and so we may get some good, intelligent questions. What you're talking about is very, very exciting. You must have been jumping up and down when you realized what you had fallen into.
This is a jaw-dropper. When I first tell people that they don't really believe, it's like another cute story. And I sit down, an Orthodox rabbi who really doesn't want to hear about science or, anything outside of the Talmud. And at the end of 10 or 15 minutes, it's like, you mean this really could be true?
Stan, hold it right there. This is CBC.